I think we should start. We are left with 1 minute. Mr. Dupree.
Let's get around.
Honorable Breitenbach.
So the deputy minister certainly gets around.
No, he's joining us from Geneva.
Yeah, Chair, sorry, I'm just, maybe I can just explain, because it does have relevance, so I'm just trying to get my camera focused. For the benefit of the Honourable Breitenbach, I'm in, and it does have relevance to the bill we're dealing with. I'm in Geneva for South Africa's Universal Periodic Review, which happens every 4 years by the United Nations Human Rights Council. We have to produce a report and then go to the plenary and have statements made or recommendations made by different states. The last one we did was in 2018. One of the issues there was passing the hate crimes, hate speech bill. And in the opening statement, we said that, and I quote, many of the recommendations made to South Africa are focused on the elimination of hate speech, hate crimes, racism, and other forms of discrimination. We're pleased to report that the prevention of and combating of hate crimes and hate speech bill is currently before Parliament and is at an advanced stage of the legislative process. So that was in response to the previous submissions. After doing the opening statement, we then got recommendations, and 11 countries, Sweden, the United Kingdom, Austria, Spain, Belgium, Eswatini, Cote d'Ivoire, Togo, Ecuador, Cape Verde, and Sierra Leone, all recommended that we expedite the passing of this bill. So I think it has been some, I think there were some sort of comments made or insinuations in it, as it were, made last time that I'm pushing this because of party issues or instructions. And actually that's not the case. It is that in terms of our international treaty bodies, we are under pressure to finalize this bill. So I just wanted to chair brief you on that so that members can also take that into account. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Deputy Minister. I think your report, in fact, or your comments are noted. They are noted, and we will take them into account as we process this bill. Also, the views of our counterparts or member states will be taken into account. I think we should start, Mr. Dupree.
Chair, Swart.
Honourable Swart.
No, Chair. I just wanted to know. I know we get a lot of correspondence, but there was a letter from the Christian media yesterday, and I wondered when we would deal with that at some stage. Maybe you can give us guidance in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Was it written to you?
No, Chair, it was addressed to you, but maybe you haven't had sight of it yet. But we can deal with it at your convenience. Thank you. Or probably when you've had sight of it, yeah.
Well, I'll read it, but we should not create an impression that we are opening public for public comment.
Yes, that's, yeah. I just wanted to, I noticed it was addressed to you, and I just wondered how one would address that and respond to it. I'm not advocating opening, but I'm just saying a response to this and other letters that are sent to the committee. I'm sure that you'll be aware how to deal with that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's also welcome the SDG, Pile. You are welcome. Mr. Dupree.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and my Deputy Minister. And I would like to take and I appreciate that the two documents that we sent to the committee was sent very late last night, so we are most probably going to provide you with a broad overview of the documents. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to share the first document with you, and I'm most probably going to ask Ms. Botha to take us through the annexure, which is the second document. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll share the first document with you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, yes. Paragraph one of our document just provides the background to why we need to submit this document to the committee. The background information as it is the rationale for the bill. Mr. Chair, yes, the Ad Hoc Joint Committee on the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination in 2000 already recommended that the Republic should consider criminalizing hate speech and especially hate crimes. And then we just provide you in paragraph 2.12 with the international obligations that the country has, especially as amplified by the minister or my deputy minister shortly after the meeting. Now, Mr. Chair, if we get to the rationale for hate crimes, and Mr. Chair, please excuse me, but I'm going to try and make this as painless as possible, because I appreciate that the members of the committee hasn't really had time to look at the 30-odd pages that we have submitted to the committee. And with regard to hate crimes, Mr. Chair, we would like to indicate that South Africa should send a very strong message that hate crimes are serious offenses and will not be tolerated in this country. With regard to rationale for hate speech, similar sentiment, but we would like to indicate or maybe just highlight to the committee that uninhibited free speech undermines social cohesion and promotes community segregation and in group formation. So that is what we would like to point out to you, Mr. Chair. Insofar as the identification of characteristics is concerned, and that goes, and we've pointed out to the committee previously that relates to the history and the social context of different countries. So what we have tried to point out to the committee is that there's no standard formula, Mr. Chair. It is up to each and every country if that country decides to promote legislation on hate crimes and hate speech to identify the characteristics that will most probably be targeted by offenders. And we would like to also indicate to the committee that it's extremely difficult, and I can, in an honest mind, tell you, Mr. Chair, that there were many, many, many hours of research being done, trying to justify what we need to, or what the committee needs to consider before identifying those characteristics. But statistics are not available. We've even gone so far as to look at statistics released by Stats SA. But there's a reason for that, Mr. Chair, and that is because we haven't got these crimes at this stage. What might be useful to the committee is to take note of paragraph 3.4, where, and I know that it might be difficult for the committee to understand why we refer to the South African Human Rights Commission's statistics, but maybe just to highlight to the committee that in, and that gives us a fair indication of where we stand at this moment, is that the SA Human Rights Commission keeps statistical data, among others, on equality complaints that they receive. And we would like to mention that in 2020 and the 2021 annual trends analysis report, it was reported that the top five rights violations included complaints in respect of equality, with an average of 682 cases over a 9-year period, and in respect of dignity, an average of 404 cases over a 5-year period. With regard to equality complaints, it was indicated in that report that the complaints were distributed as follows. Race, 60%, Mr. Chair. Any other ground? And we haven't had the opportunity to establish what any other ground is, but in any event, it's 14%. Then disability, 8%. Sexual orientation, 6%. Religion, 4%. Ethnic or social origin, 4%. And then age, color, gender, language and birth, all of them, 1% of the complaints that the commission received. Now, the identification of the grounds, Mr. Chair, and the correct characteristics is, we've already mentioned to the committee various times that it depends on the social context and the history of a country, and then forward trends with regard to those type of offences that will be committed. Mr. Chair, I am most probably going to indicate to you the next few paragraphs are devoted to indicating to the committee that Section 2C is not the be-all and end-all of what is included in the bill before you. But we would like to indicate to the committee that that was a starting point. And among other things, we have, the department has consulted widely with interested parties, and the inputs that have been received were taken into serious consideration, and we have eventually then, and please excuse me for using the word we. I mean the department has ended up with the characteristics that were included in the introduced version of the bill, as well as the grounds which apply to Section 4 of the bill. But we will get back to the impact of or the influence of the Kwalani judgment in a short while, Mr. Chair. But we would like to indicate to the committee, and the question was raised in a previous meeting of the committee, why and how were those characteristics identified? So the starting point was 16.2. With regard to 16.2, we would say that those four grounds listed there are non-debatable, if we could put it that way. So those are a given. And then the reference was made to Section 9.3, and then based on the input received from various interest parties, additional grounds were added. And once again, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I know that I'm skipping a lot, but I appreciate that the committee members haven't had the opportunity to look at the document yet. What we would like to point out, Mr. Chair, is among others, this paragraph, which indicates to us that even if we follow 16.2C and 9.3 of PAPUDA, and the Constitution, it does not prevent the legislature from adding analogous grounds. That would be the essence for us at this stage. We are making the point here, Mr. Chair, in paragraph 3.12, that we, well, if I say we, I apologize. The department's argument is that we can go wider than 16.2C and even 9.3 of the Constitution. And that is where we are making the point, Mr. Chair. We also quote from the Kwalani judgment, and what I would like to point out to the committee is that in that judgment, it was indicated that it is best left to Parliament to deal with, and that relates to the grounds or the characteristics. We have also got an extensive quote from the judgment with regard to analogous grounds. I am not going to read it line by line with your permission, Mr. Chair. What we would like to indicate to the committee at this stage is that in the Kwalani judgment, the court found that the expansion of those grounds to include analogous grounds does not render the definition of prohibited grounds unconstitutional. Now, that is, of course, with regard to the definition of prohibited grounds contained in Papua. What the court also said is that the extended prayer grounds are narrowly crafted to fulfill the purpose of the hate speech provision. Now, I would like to pause here, Mr. Chair, and I would like to maybe just take you back to the introductory remarks made by the department, and that is that this bill, and it adds to what the deputy minister has said to you, but this bill is very, very long overdue. In 2000, the Ad Hoc Joint Committee, their report as approved by the National Assembly, well, actually by Parliament, already recommended that hate speech legislation should be promoted, and because they were well aware of the fact that they only provide for civil remedies. Now, Mr. Chair, with regard to the limitation analysis, we have also provided information to you. I'm not going to, I don't want to force this upon you. I think the members will have the opportunity to read through our document. But we argue that it's a question of, and we would like to maybe highlight paragraph 3.20 of our submission as well. Highlighted area. And that is where we want to come back to the point that we do not really have empirical data or statistics with regard to the amount or number of hate crimes being committed. In the media, a lot of attention in the past were on instances of hate speech, but that is what is available to us. And I think if one lives in South Africa, you are sensitive towards these things. You know that it happens, but you can't give numbers. And those numbers are not available because we are not calling it offences at this stage. With regard to the freedom of expression and the limitation thereof, we have also provided the committee with examples. And maybe I could just highlight to the committee that there are many, many examples of the restriction of freedom of expression. Among others, then let me just highlight this one to you, Mr. Chair, is the criminal prohibition on the expression of contempt of court, ex facto curiae. Those things have never been challenged. So it does not mean that freedom of expression is the be all and end all of a society like ours. It is that freedom is subject to other interests. And that's the important point that we would like to make in these paragraphs, is to indicate to the committee that apart from the fact that the department is very, very cautious on limiting the right to freedom of expression, but, Mr. Chair, it goes to the heart of things, and that is to say, listen, we are dealing with the dignity of other persons. And that is, I think, the strongest message that we would like to present to the committee at this stage, is to say that hate crimes and hate speech really go to the heart of the dignity of persons. And then nearly at the conclusion, Mr. Chair, we would like to indicate to the committee that the introduced bill aimed to criminalize hate speech that is harmful or incites harm, or, and we've underlined that for you, promote or propagate hatred. So it was a wide test, Chair. What constitutes hate speech in terms of the introduced version of the bill is a wide test, to the extent that it qualifies as such if the speech complies with one of the two sets of criteria. Now, Mr. Chair, this is very important. The introduced version of the bill had two sets of criteria. Now, the disjunctive or introduced two separate tests. The definition of harm, as introduced in the bill, was also very wide. Now, Mr. Chair, the proposed amendments to the definition of harm and clause 4.1 are significant to the extent that it is intended to bring more clarity of what is meant with harm. The definition of harm should be read with clause 4.1 of the bill, of course, and then the test for speech to qualify as hate speech will, as proposed in the working document that was submitted to the committee, have to comply with both sets of criteria, namely, it must be harmful or incite harm, and it must promote or propagate hatred. Mr. Chair, in conclusion, we would like to indicate to the committee that the bill aims to send a clear message that incidents of hate crimes and hate speech will not be tolerated by the state. There are limited statistics relating to hate crimes and hate speech being committed against persons or groups or persons based on the listed characteristics and grounds which are contained in or which refer to clauses 3 and 4 of the bill, and the listed characteristics and especially the grounds should not be overemphasized at the cost of the aim of the bill, namely to address the plight of persons against whom these type of offenses have been committed in a manner that negatively affects their dignity. And we cannot overemphasize the whole issue around a person's dignity, Mr. Chair. And then finally, the grounds that are analogous to those that are contained in Sections 9.3 and 62 of the Constitution, and then, of course, Papura, could be included in clauses 3 and 4 of the bill because the rationale of the underlying policy of this bill is very different to those provisions of Papura. And that actually brings me to the conclusion of our first note, Mr. Chair. With your permission, I will now share the second document, but I would like Ms. Buerta maybe to, if she's willing, to take us through that document.
Maybe before you do that, I must just ask members whether they would want to engage this document or they would want to wait for the second document and engage both of them together.
Chair Swartje, is there a link between the two? I haven't had, tried to glance through it, but there's annex. Sorry, Chair. I see there are hands up.
Okay, maybe let's just allow you to speak, and then we will, then Honorable Horn and Honorable Breitenbach will follow. So, is there a link between the first document and the second document?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you very much. Yes, there is a link because we would like to indicate in the second document the justification for the separate grounds that are included, especially in clause 3, but also then in clause 4. So, and once again, Chair, I must admit, it's anecdotal information at most, or in the majority of times, but as I said, if you live in South Africa, you know what's going on in the country. So, yes, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Juan.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have a firm view as to whether we must first get the presentation on Annexure A or not. What I rather wanted to address is, I think as Mr. De Pre indicated, I only saw this document early this morning, and I have quickly perused it. So I, of course, will be willing and able to have a preliminary engagement with the department and Mr. De Pre on this, but I would want to suggest that certain aspects of this first document in any event needs a bit of more careful consideration in order to have a full engagement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and good morning to everybody. Yes, I support Honorable Horn. We received the documents late yesterday, and I'm not blaming anybody for that. I have read them. I will be able to engage on them peripherally, but we are going to need a lot more time to interpret them properly in order to be able to properly engage with the issues raised therein. There are serious issues raised therein, and there are serious arguments for and against, and they need proper consideration. So any engagement on either of them today is fine, but it's going to be superficial and peripheral, and any in-depth engagement is going to require more time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Can I suggest the following, that we divide the submissions or the suggestions made by Honorable Horn and Honorable Breitenbach into two parts. I think one part, it was to answer the question whether we should engage on this document now or we should wait for Ms. Botha to also brief us on the second document, because there are linkages, there's a link between the two documents. And I think on that one, there seems to be an agreement or no violent opposition that let's have the both documents presented now, and then we might have engagement after the two documents have been presented. And then I think after the two presentations have been made, then we can come to the suggestion made by Honorable Horn and Honorable Breitenbach, that we engage with the document, but they still need a further consideration. They would treat this as a preliminary engagement. Let's come to that debate after we have had the impact after we have had on Ms. Botha, and then the two documents are before us for consideration. So let's first deal with the first one, which was the question that was, I think, raised by Honorable Swart, and I think it's a correct procedural question. And I think the agreement is that let's listen to both presentations, and then we can engage. And after we have engaged, what will be our way forward, then we'll come to the issues raised by Honorable Horn and Honorable Breitenbach. Will that be in order?
That's fine, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Botha?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning. Thank you, Mr. Dupre, for your introduction and for taking us through the notes. Working off of what Mr. Dupre has said, this annexure is an explanation of the grounds that we have in the bill. So it's an explanation of the characteristics which relate to Clause 3 of the bill and the grounds which relate to Clause 4 of the bill. But of course, there is overlap between those characteristics and the grounds. We have moved from the assumption that the grounds set out in Section 16.2c of the Constitution, that's race, ethnicity, gender, and religion, are non-negotiable and they need not be justified. And that's also based off of our understanding of international instruments, particularly the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and ICERD, which is the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. So you'll see that Mr. Dupre highlighted,
yes. I think there are other people who are following on YouTube and on YouTube who are watching at home. I think that's for their benefit. When you say emphasis apply, can you explain that so that we take everybody along with us as we are going through the pen? So can you explain to the broader public this emphasis applied?
Yes, thank you, Jay. Emphasis applied just means that we as the department have highlighted or underlined certain parts of the excerpt and certain parts of the quote. So where it says emphasis applied or own emphasis, it just means that we as the department want to highlight these particular words in the quote or in the document for ease of reading and just to make our point better or stand out more.
Thank you very much.
Sure. So if we move on to the integral part of ICERD, which I said is the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, I just want to point out that we ratified that on the 10th of December 1998. And Article 4 of that convention requires that states have an obligation to declare hate speech and any act of or incitement to violence which is directed at persons of a particular race, group, another color or ethnic group to be a criminal offense. And so our reading of the convention confirms that we need to take steps towards criminalization of hate crimes and hate speech. And like Mr. Dupre has said, that is long overdue in South Africa. This is an international convention that we ratified in 1998. So just as we go along, you'll see that we have underlined and highlighted color, and that's also going to become apparent as we move down. We've also highlighted color in Section 9 of the Constitution and in PIPEDA. And like Mr. Dupre has pointed out, we have used Section 16.2c and 9.3 of the Constitution, as well as PIPEDA, as a starting point or as the basis off of which we have developed the grounds and the characteristics for this bill. You'll see we also have an excerpt from the EEA, the Employment Equity Act, where we've also underlined colour. And that's in relation to one of the grounds that we deal with first, which is colour. I do just want to, before we go into the grounds, I want to reiterate something that Mr. Dupuy mentioned in our note, and that's a para 3.93 of our note, and the methods of victim selection. I just think that it's important to reiterate that now before we go into the grounds, because it sort of sets the backdrop of sort of why we have chosen these grounds. And like Mr. Dupree has said, and like we have mentioned in our note, there are different methods of victim selection, and they include a group identity, immutability, and that is characteristics which cannot or are incapable of changing. It includes a history of discrimination and oppression, and it includes vulnerability and difference. So the characteristics and grounds that we have selected for inclusion in the bill are a mixture of these four victim selection models or categories. If we can then move to colour, which is one of our, which is the first ground that we've discussed, where it says emphasis applied in the previous page of our annexure, that has related to colour, just to show that colour is mentioned in these international instruments, as well as our own domestic legislation. There's a quite a useful article by Faria, which we've excerpted. If I can just highlight a few portions of it, there were debates about colour and whether race includes colour. And Faria notes that the inclusion of colour in the Universal Declaration, which we just covered, and in the ICESCR and in the ICCPR, draws attention to colorism. And colorism is defined as practice of discrimination based on skin tone, and that is prevalent throughout the world. And all of these excerpts establish that color is a form of discrimination, and it is a violation of human rights. If we can move on to the next ground, and that's nationality, migrant, refugee status for asylum seekers. And then next we'll go through sexual orientation. But just if we speak to nationality, migrant status, refugee or asylum seekers, there's an article that's written by Professor Nell and Duncan Breen, who are part of the Hate Crimes Working Group, and they write about violence against foreign nationals that's been noted as a major social challenge in South Africa as far back as 1998. And there are some examples of what trends of violence against foreign nationals include that are set out there. If we could maybe then go to the next ground, which is sexual orientation and gender-based violence, gender identity, gender expression, and sex characteristics. I just want to highlight one caution. This is also from an article by Nell and Breen. And they say that they use the wording LGBTI people are targets of general violence and crime. However, because they're stigmatized for their perceived sexual and or gender deviance, LGBTI people are also frequently discriminated against through criminal acts because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, and or biological variance. Often hate speech such as harassment, slurring, name calling, and other forms of verbal abuse creates the breeding ground for hate-based attacks. They have also, in the rest of our excerpts, there is more information about exactly what that includes. If we can skip to the next ground, that's albinism. We have excerpted articles which speak to albinism and a threat to people who suffer with or people who have albinism. So there's an article by Ms. Msuela, which is entitled "Violent Attacks Against Persons with Albinism in South Africa, the Human Rights Perspective." And it highlights some really quite distressing stories of people who are attacked, who have albinism, and the stories including abduction, killings of persons with albinism. If I can highlight one portion, mysterious abduction and killings of persons with albinism evoke feelings of uneasiness and insecurity in the communities and make them reluctant to walk, travel, or stay alone because of the possible dangers. As a vulnerable minority group, persons with albinism are in need of social and legal protection for them to enjoy the full spectrum of their human rights. So we can skip to the next ground. It's age and sex, and that's because the information that we have excerpted from primarily the SAOPF, you'll see that it lies sort of at the intersection of age and sex, particularly the vulnerability of older women. I am not going to go into too much detail here because I don't want to take too much time, but if I can highlight an SAOPF presentation on older persons in South Africa, the SAOPF has highlighted that the safety and security of older persons is largely underreported and is escalating at an alarming rate for the abuse and exploitation of older persons, claims of witchcraft primarily against older women and the prevalence of human rights abuses, and that many of the attacks against older persons are horrific, brutal, and downright evil. If we can then skip to the next round, which is trade and occupation, sex and gender, we've excerpted from an article by Professor Amanda Huss, who has written about the decriminalization of sex work in South Africa, and written about the recent finding of the decomposed bodies of six women, four of whom were identified as sex workers. There's also another article just further down the page that's about violence against sex workers. And it's also excerpted from a report by Human Rights Watch as to why sex work should be decriminalized in South Africa. And it highlights some really terrifying stories by sex workers who were violently attacked, beaten and raped. If we then skip to the next ground, it is birth. And I know that in the document, it is blank. This morning I found two cases relating to birth. If I could just go through them very quickly, and I will give citations. The first is Wilkinson and another versus Crawford, Nominee of Sikio and others. It's a 2021 decision by the Constitutional Court. And in that decision, the Constitutional Court had to deal with testation and freedom of testation vis-a-vis adopted children, and whether adopted children could be included as heirs. And the Constitutional Court considered relevant provisions of the Constitution and case law, and it answered in the affirmative. It held that unfair discrimination against adopted children is contrary to public policy. and therefore the exclusion in the wall that was the source of the case was unenforceable. And the other case, which is an older case, the 2003 case, it's Peterson versus maintenance officer and others, that dealt with a 1930 case called Moton and another versus Houston, which that tells that in terms of our common law, the paternal grandfather of an external child owes no duty of support to the child. And the court in Peterson dealt with whether this was constitutional. And the court in Peterson held that the common law rule, which differentiates between children born in wedlock and extramarital children, not only denies extramarital children an equal right to be maintained by their paternal grandparents, but conveys the notion that they do not have the same inherent worth and dignity as children who are born in wedlock. And so the court in Peterson held that the differentiation between duty of support of grandparents towards children born in wedlock and extramarital children, in that is the wording used in Peterson case, constitutes unfair discrimination on the ground of birth and amounts to an infringement on the dignity of those children. If we can move to the next round, which is culture, we have excerpted an article by City Press, which discusses cultural diversity on our continent. If we can then skip to disability, we have excerpted an article by Holness and I just want to in particular point out that crimes against persons with disabilities are often pernicious, but often invisible. And this stems from two factors, the vulnerability of persons with disabilities and the widely held belief that disability resides in an individual rather than a social response to difference. And that law enforcement fails to identify the disability as an element in the offence, due to the invisibility of some disabilities and because of prejudice and ignorance of disability. If we can speak to the next round, that's ethnic or social origin, and we have excerpted from an article by Naidu on ethnicity and the rationale for protecting ethnicity. I'm not going to stay too long. If we can maybe skip to the next round, which is HIV or AIDS status. There we have excerpted from quite a few different articles highlighting different aspects of HIV AIDS stigmatization and some of the prejudices which result in difficulties for those with HIV and AIDS. I'm just going to skip through it quite quickly. We also have excerpted from a UN AIDS document. There's discrimination in family and community settings, and that could include ostracization, could lead to verbal harassment, physical violence, verbal discrediting, blaming, gossip, denial of traditional funeral rites, and then discrimination in institutional settings, which includes access to healthcare, a reduced standard of care, denial of access to care and treatment, breaches of confidentiality. If we could then skip to the next ground, which is language. Here we have excerpted from different cases dealing with language policy. So we've excerpted from a constitutional court judgment about the language policy in Urban High School, We've also accepted from other constitutional cases on language policies in universities. So the University of the Free State, for example, you'll see later on. And the Constitutional Court also noted the importance of language and the importance of language and its next dignity. If we could then maybe skip to the next the final grounds and political affiliation and conviction, we've excerpted from news articles and also an academic article called The Provincial Concern Political Coolings in South Africa, which highlights the trend of political killings and what is a political killing. They've tracked the trends from 2000 they've tracked the trends since, I think, 1994 and 2000. And there's another new article which says that there's a worrying trend of political assassinations and that voters of two wards have had to elect new representatives following the murder of two councillors. So that is the final ground. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much, Ms. Botha. I would just like to thank the Ms. Botha, Mr. Dupree. I think Ms. Pillay, who is the overall leader, whether we agree or we don't agree with what is written here, but what we can't take away is that a lot of work has gone into this research and the writing of the two documents within a short space of time. Thank you very much for that work. I think it gives us an opportunity to be able to engage one another in a better informed position. Thank you for the hard work put into these two documents. Deputy Minister, do you want to say something before I allow members to interact with the document?
No, Chair, but thanks. This camera's not really working. No, Chair, but thanks. Thanks for maybe just to say that as an indication of the dedication of the employees of the Department of Justice, Ms. Pillay is in fact on leave today in Durban, but has come in especially to attend this meeting. Thanks, Chair. But I'll respond, I think, after members have spoken. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much. Members, that is the presentation of the two documents. I have Honorable Horn and Honorable Breitenbach, followed by Honorable Velma and Honorable Swartz and Honorable Jelle in that order. Honorable Horn.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I have a few questions and then a few remarks, but as previously stated, would also like to put on record that this must please not be seen as a final reaction or an engagement, with your permission. Chair, the first is that in terms of the reference to the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, more or less at the beginning of the first document, I would want to inquire from the department whether there's specific obligations to criminalize discrimination outside of racial discrimination in terms of our international obligations. So this convention obviously makes it clear, and as quoted there in Article 4, places an obligation on signatory states to create an offence on their statute books to ultimately give effect to the absolute duty on everybody to eliminate racial discrimination. So that's the first thing that came to mind. Then, Chair, in respect of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, there is a quote which I think at a first glance the department uses to now also justify the newly introduced term of proneness to vulnerability, and that is the quote that talks about more likely to be targeted. From my initial reading of this, and I've not seen the context within the document, of course, it is, however, quite clear that there is a specific reference here to hate crimes. So in that sense, I would want to hear from the department whether they believe that is then equally applicable to hate, the criminalization of hate speech. Because I must say, Chair, that the use of the term proneness to vulnerability, specifically in the hate speech context, would seem to me to be possibly exactly inconsistent with sections 133 and 134 as quoted there on page 9 from the Kualani judgment, in the sense that those specific portions of the Kualani judgment already makes it very clear that what we must work with is narrowly crafted grounds. Whilst, as I understand this document now, it is quite clear that the expansion of criteria seems to be based rather on the likelihood for future targeting or proneness to vulnerability. In that sense, Chair, I also want to say that, and I will study the document further to maybe just not be unfair to the department, but this document seems to me to work from a point of departure that ultimately what is in play when we contemplate criminalizing hate speech, and even in respect of the expansion of criteria in terms of hate crimes in relation to what is firstly identified in our constitution, is policy considerations. And I would be very worried if that is indeed the argument, in that it's quite clear, and I think the balance of the document also makes it clear from the department that ultimately we cannot, in making this law, work on the assumption that all of this is based on policy consideration, because there's clearly constitutional considerations at play. Then, Chair, I must say that I would want a further explanation of the statements made by the department in the first document in paragraphs 310 and 311. On a first reading and even listening to Mr. Dupria this morning, I must say that those, the arguments in those two paragraphs, I cannot yet make sense of. 310 on the one hand says that it's not necessary to explain why the list of characteristics and grounds in the bill are expanded or extended. I would want to argue that statement in itself is very problematic, because the moment there's a limitation, it has to be explained and justified. And then in a somewhat odd way, it then goes on in order to try and explain or justify the expansion of the list beyond what is in section 16 to 7 and 9.3 of the Constitution by saying there does not need to be a duplication of those sections in order for the grounds and characteristics identified in the bill to be justified. So those are on a first reading, and maybe a further explanation can put one's mind that is, I want to say, very problematic statements in light of the, as we understand it, the clear obligation for a clear justification of grounds that in fact go beyond 16 to 7, as we've discussed at length in previous meetings. And there is our reference, Chair, also to the so-called rationale behind the hate crimes and hate speech. But I want to say that it is all fine, and I think all of us ultimately would be able to align ourselves with a firm declaration that hate speech and even hate crimes in this country must not be tolerated. But that doesn't ultimately or automatically, in my view, leads to a situation, as we've previously discussed, where the criminalization of specifically speech and the inclusion of certain forms of speech as criminal hate speech is justified. It would seem to me at this stage, unless I can get a better explanation, that the argument is somewhat circular from the department by saying the rationale is to root out these forms of behavior, and then later on they are criminalized, and that would then justify the rationale, which is as I say, somewhat strange. Then the last question I have in respect of the first document, before I move on quickly to the second document, Chair, is on 323, where the department makes reference to other forms of limitation on freedom of expression. And I, in respect of subclause 1 there, would want to touch base with the department somewhat further. From my understanding, I would think firstly about the regulation, or if then it is so, the possible prohibition on certain forms of public demonstration is not strictly speaking only a free speech or freedom of expression issue. Two, it is also a freedom of movement and a freedom of to participate in political activity, etc., etc. But secondly, Jay, my understanding of the criminal prohibition on certain forms of public demonstration is that it was in fact found to be unconstitutional, and at this stage the only obligation on anyone who wants to embark on public demonstrations is to A, inform the relevant authority, and then B, apply for permission in as far as it enables the relevant local authority and the South African Police Services to properly regulate it. So the old criminal sanction on linked to public demonstrations in certain circumstances, to the best of my knowledge, and this is, as I say, just on a initial reaction, one would want to study that a bit further, has been found to be unconstitutional, although, as I say, to my mind, it is in some way linked to freedom of expression, but it's rather linked also to other rights in our constitution. Okay, if I then turn to Annexure A, and one would want to study that a bit further, I want to say that on an initial reading, or as Ms. Berta took us through this document, in respect of one or two of these criteria, I would want to say that I think good anecdotal evidence at least was shared, if not evidence, that at least anecdotal information, which would could possibly justify the inclusion of these criteria. However, want to say that, again, going back to the narrow crafting obligation referenced also in Kualani, that I would want to ask the department whether it is of the view that when it identifies criteria like group identity, immutability, history of discrimination and vulnerability, whether in order to craft the law narrowly, one shouldn't argue that all four of those criteria should be present. It would seem on the department's version at the moment that it works on the view that any one of those four criteria, if it is satisfied, would then enable inclusion. And I would think that if one works towards a narrow crafting as instructed by the court, that one should consider whether all four should not be included. And then if I add my previous questions around the new term today, proneness to vulnerability, I would think that specifically in respect of the hate speech provisions in the bill, that it would be very problematic. Chair, I don't want to spend at this stage. I will reserve the right to go into the submission more carefully. So I don't want to go into each of those criteria, but maybe to say around paragraph 14, I find the inclusion of language policy related cases, all related to the Afrikaans language, to be very problematic as a justification. To my mind, and maybe I am overly sensitive because I am one of the 44 Afrikaans speakers left in South Africa, if you can believe Charlize Theron, as she now is known. So maybe I am a bit sensitive about this this morning, but I find it highly problematic if the idea is that there must be discrimination against one on the basis of language. And then if one looks towards the other aspects, that the inclusion of these specific cases then seems to indicate that the only circumstances in which there could then be a criminal act on the basis of discrimination along language lines would be then if it is perpetrated by people who speak Afrikaans. And in that sense, I would want to say that it is unacceptable. In any event, if we are making a law, if that's the justification for inclusion, and of course this is now a matter of public record, we see how our courts quote from both discussions in portfolio committees and in debates around what the legislature was thinking. I must immediately say that if the idea is to position this country to criminalize the attempts by Afrikaans speakers to exercise their language rights and see that as quite possibly creating a rebuttable presumption that any attempts to exercise their language rights is already grounds for to find that there is discrimination against other language groups, then that alone will ultimately, at least to my mind, be very problematic. And I would also want to venture an opinion to say that this would mean that this is not a law of general application, if that is the justification around language as it stands now in Annexure A. But regarding the other criteria, we would like to study that further and maybe engage further. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Horn. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to everybody. I don't want to repeat what Honorable Horn has already said. Safe to say that I fully agree with all of his inputs. I would like to add that I'm working on the assumption that we're trying to craft and create proper legislation for proper purposes, and that the final intention of this is to make or pass legislation that is useful and honest in its attempt to address the issues that we are now discussing. Having read these two documents, as I said, quite quickly, I hold the view that is not what we're doing here. I'm not at all convinced that the passing of this legislation will address the issues that we say we want to address, particularly the prosecution of these issues. I don't believe that this legislation will make it easy for prosecutors to prosecute these matters. I think it will make it almost impossible for police to investigate these matters. I think that we're not taking into account the practicalities of investigating and prosecuting and proving on a balance of on a beyond reasonable doubt basis these crimes that we are now discussing. And I think that a lot more thought needs to go into crafting this legislation if we are going to pass legislation that meets the prescripts of what we say we want to do. As it stands, I believe it's an almost impossible task for anybody to prosecute in terms of the legislation as it stands before us now. So we need to consider that, or what is it that we're doing here? And if it is to craft legislation that allows police and prosecutors to investigate and prosecute these matters, then this will not meet that goal. So I think we need a lot more interrogation of these aspects. I think we need to a lot more in-depth engagement. I would like to consult subject matter experts on the issues that bother me. There are subject matter experts available in South Africa who can consult on those issues to form a proper view. As a prosecutor, I have formed a view of how very, very difficult it will be to achieve what this bill says it wants to achieve. And so I don't think that we're going to achieve what we have to achieve just on the face of it. I also want to support Honorable Horn, his comments on the inclusion of only Afrikaans. Afrikaans might not be my first language, it certainly is my second language, and I take great exception to the way that it's set out in these documents. And again, I reiterate my point, Mr. Chair, that we are nowhere near being finished with our engagements and deliberations on this bill. There's a lot of ground to cover. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Plettenberg. Honorable Newport Trochen.
Thank you very much, Chair. And good morning to everybody on the platform. I would like to thank the department for the work done on the two documents. I haven't read them as yet, but I do want to read them in detail first. I have just taken note of a few things. In terms of statistics provided by the South African Human Rights Commission, I believe that those numbers are actually low. I think in reality, those numbers should be higher because there are a lot of reports of you know, hate speech and behavior in that way. I would also like to refer to many cases of where children are born, but, you know, they're born with a disability, and then the parents, or usually the father, because they do not accept the child with a disability, then they leave the family. And that is in itself is discrimination. And also in the case of deaf people, which I know specifically, let's say the deceased parent will leave the house or the property to the disabled child or the deaf child, and then that will is not followed through and the person does not receive what is due to them, and then they are not able to access legal assistance in that case. I know of cases of that specifically, and they can't access legal assistance. And then to the department, in South African Sign Language, many people celebrate it, but many people are anti or discriminating against South African Sign Language. Maybe it's not hate speech, maybe it's not a hate crime, but why is this? This is a phenomenon that's coming up. And, you know, maybe it's because the disabled community is not educated enough that they can report it, or maybe they don't have the funding for legal assistance, legal services, but they get discriminated against just on the basis of using sign language. And so that's why I believe that the statistics from the South African Human Rights Commission could actually be higher than what is noted. But yes, I would like to end off by saying I would like to read the documents in more detail, and then I can have further comments. What happens out there is really painful, but there's nowhere to report it and nowhere to record it. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ewart Grohan. Honorable Swart.
No, thank you, Chair, and also my thanks to the department and to Ms. Pillay in particular for coming in on a day of leave. I don't know if I would have done that, but it does show commitment. So I just want to start by the issue that the Deputy Minister said about the pressure to pass the legislation. And this, I appreciate that it's come some way, but I want to emphasize that the guidance that we got from the Constitutional Court in the Quilani matter only came out in the latter part of last year, was July of last year. And in all our deliberations in the Justice Portfolio Committee in the previous parliament, we at that stage, firstly, did not believe it was necessary. You will remember, Deputy Minister, to pass the hate speech. But we secondly, for the issue of doubt, we said, well, let's wait to hear what the Quilani judgment would say. There was a very strong sense to split the two bills, split the two parts of hate crimes and hate speech, given the fact that, as we've said continuously, and this is one of the issues I've got with the document that says, page 4, 3.7, no such relief is present And the Deputy Minister himself corrected that assertion previously, where we know that in terms of Section 21 of PAPUDA, there is reference to referring matters for criminal prosecution. And we know in terms of the common law, there has been successful prosecution for crimen in jure in the Sparrow and a number of other matters, which sadly are not pointed out in any of these documents. And I don't understand why. Why is the broad assertion made no such relief is present when there is relief present? Can be argued it could be more narrow, but I don't think it's correct to say there's no such relief present. Secondly, on the issue of the United Nations, where the Deputy Minister is at the moment, I would also ask why the issues relating to the United Nations Redbat Plan of Action, which states that criminal sanctions must be the last resort, is not referred to in any documents. In fact, the United Nations Redbat Plan of Action says civil sanctions and remedies should be considered, and that we know is in terms of PAPUDA. So there is a high threshold test set out in that United Nations document. And I would ask the department to please consult that document and to make sure that what is being presented would satisfy the Rabat Plan of Action highlights. And it speaks about the six parts there. And it has been pointed out by previous submissions to the department, but there's no mention of it. And I've got a problem with that. I would like the department to answer then on page 3 of its document. The department has to rely on interested parties to provide anecdotal information. Who are those interested parties? Is it the hate speech group? And because I noticed in the second document, there's a quote, rightfully, anyone can be quoted from, by Mr. Nell, who is part of the hate speech grouping and is entitled, and I appreciate that quote, but as we know, he also gave evidence in the Quilani judgment. So we would like to know how objective it is and who's been consulted, because one would expect a broader consultation when it comes to drafting of documents, because one doesn't want to get the impression that only a certain narrative is being presented when we're dealing with very controversial piece of legislation, particularly when it comes to the hate speech. I don't have a major problem with the hate crimes aspect, maybe just the additional categories, one would have to look at that. But I would like these explanations to be provided. Because as we know, and Mr. Dupre correctly pointed out that hate crimes, hate speech goes to the heart of the dignity of people. But there are other judgments that speak about the importance of freedom of expression. The Mandela case, Mandela versus Falati, in a free society, all freedoms are important, but they are not equally important. Political philosophers are agreed about the primacy of freedom of speech. It is the freedom upon which all other freedoms depend. It is the freedom without which others would no longer endure. The Masuka judgment, freedom of expression lies at the heart of democracy. And this is the balance that we're trying to achieve. And this is where hate speech and the criminalization of that, the further criminalization, let me emphasize, the further criminalization has to be balanced against the impact that that will have. And we know the African Charter speaks of, emphasizes a lot on freedom of expression to balance that against dictatorships, against authoritarianism, and against the chilling effect that such hate speech provisions would have on freedom of expression, freedom of religion, and others. And that's the balance that we're trying to strike here, but it is a challenge. I would also like to know why there's no reference to the successful criminal prosecutions in the Sparrow matters. Why is that totally just ignored as though it doesn't exist at all? Chair, I would also then join the issue about Afrikaans. En ek is bitter bekommerd oor die feit dat dit uitgesonder word in die dokument. And I think that we need an explanation as to why this has been done. And I'll leave it at that. I'll just join my colleagues in expressing my concerns in that regard. Chairperson, I haven't had the time to go through these documents in great, great detail. But I think there's a lot of work that still needs to be done when it comes to this bill. And I think that these documents are helpful as a starting point, but there are clauses that just on the first reading that I have got a concern about in the way that it's been phrased. If you take 3.13, and almost there is a I don't quite understand why the Uitgangspunt, the starting point, should not be section 16.2. It's like almost no, policy considerations, we don't have to start there, but surely you start at 16.2. That's where we must start. And you move from, because everything will be tested against 16.2 as we're trying to pass legislation that is not only desirable or needed, but which is also constitutionally compliant. When you see the clause that is quoted on page 8, 128, the inclusion of HIV/AIDS as a grant, I'm interested. Yes, I appreciate that the highlighted part, the emphasis supplied, is best left to Parliament. But there is a important clause there. The remaining potentially vexed inclusions are those that are wide-ranging and may elicit apprehension about interference by the draconian thought police, like the concepts of conscience and belief. There are well-grounded fears that their inclusion may impermissibly encroach upon the right to freedom of expression. And then we go to the end. It is best left to Parliament to deal with. Yes, we're dealing with it, but we are mindful of what the court has said, that there are well-grounded fears that the inclusion of broader categories may impermissibly encroach upon the right to freedom of expression. So I think this is the challenge we're faced with, Chair, as we go forward. These documents are helpful. We will need to go into them with great detail and consult other groupings as well. So, Chair, with those comments, I again appreciate the input, and I would like some responses to some of the questions I've put. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart. Honourable Jale.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning. And Chair, let me just echo the words of our colleagues, just to appreciate and thank the department for the good work that they have done. I think these documents that we have now, they are really, for me, Chair, helpful for us to be able to go forward in our discussions on this difficult matter. That Chairperson but needs to be given a thorough attention. And Chair, also, I just want also to thank the department also for indicating to us the Article 2, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because all that they have given to us, Chair, it is the information that we need to work on to make sure that we reach a conclusion on this matter. And I also would want to thank the department, Chair, for their emphasis on this matter when they indicate to us that we need to deal with this matter once and for all. We have to make sure, Chair, that we leave no stone unturned. I just want to summarize and add to what the department was saying. Chairperson, I wouldn't like us to pick and one or two things and emphasize on the issues, as some of my colleagues have indicated on the issues of language and all that. I think all languages are important. And if there is any danger, any language, because even the Zulus will come and say their language is important, even the Tswanas, everybody. We know the constitution, the constitutional imperative on this matter. So let's just say, Chair, we will get the opportunity to read these documents and then come back, Chair, and give more input in making sure that everything is accommodated. And this, to me, this is the opportunity, Chair, where if we are able as the country to use this opportunity to reverse the ills of apartheid. Because if you check, Chair, this discussion that we are about today, the reason why there is no research, much research on this matter, it is because that apartheid is, South Africa is the foundation of apartheid. We impacted to the world all that we are crying about. If you check some of the things that we have been talking about earlier, even before this document, are only happening here in South Africa. There are very few when you go outside the country. That is why it is even difficult to get a rich research around this matter. So we are left as a country to make sure that what our forefathers who fought for this democracy that we are enjoying today, we make sure that we make them proud, because they have put the Constitution as a founding document for us to relate to in order to be able to correct that which needs to be reversed, Chair. So for me, I am happy up to this far. Let's come back, because this document, indeed, I agree with my colleagues that we need to go back and read and make sure that we come with the, we close the matter. On that, Chair, I would say thank you very much for today. I will stop here.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jada. I think you wanted to say not your forefathers does not exclude women who have fought for this country.
True, Jay. When I say forefathers, I include everybody. Thank you.
Yes, but I think you have raised a very important point. It is not an intention, our intention, and I don't think that even the department's intention to exclude any of the languages. All South African languages are equally important, and they need to be protected, all of them. Members, can we have a 10-minute break before we allow the department led by the Deputy Minister to respond to the issues we have raised? Can we come back at 20 past 11?
Recording stopped.
Okay, can we start? I will now hand over to the Deputy Minister.
Recording in progress.
Deputy Minister John Jeffrey.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry, still battling with the with the camera. It's not easy being in a hotel room. Chair, look, I'd like to start the response we can see if the officials need to respond to specific points, but Mr. Horn's point about the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, obviously its concern is about racism. So that's why it's only going to be limited to that. But other treaties have including this UPR process that we're involved in at the moment, are broader than that. Mr. Swart, on the issue of the rebut, the rebut plan of action. That is a part of a report from the UN Human Commission of Human Rights, and it was an expert workshop on the prohibition of incitement to national, racial, or religious hatred. So it was a group of experts. It was from 2013. They do caution, as does our court, we need to be careful of restricting free speech. But that is something that our courts have also been cautioning. So there's not anything particularly new, but no, we've read the rebut principles. It's a committee of experts. Presumably, it's part of the UN Human Rights Council process. It was asked for by the UN Human Rights Commissioner. So it's part of the process, and these requests or recommendations that we expedite the passing of the bill are coming in spite of that from a wide range of states. Then just wanted, Mr. Swart also raises the issue of why is there no mention of Penny Sparrow and the prosecutions that have taken place. Well, that is because they were convicted under criminal injuria, and we raised right from the start that we're not repealing criminal injuria, but we wanted a statutory bill dealing with hate speech. Mr. Swart refers to other remedies, like PAPUDA refers to referral to the prosecutor. But Mr. Swart, as you would recall, when PAPUDA was passed, the committee of, I think you were part of it, had said there needed to be legislation on hate speech. And the bill doesn't refer to criminal injuria, it refers to hate speech. Now, we don't have a formal crime of hate speech currently in South Africa. That is what we're trying to do, consistent with what the committee that adopted PAPUDA said all those years ago. I wanted to take us back to the bill because I think there's a lot of, I think the bill is not complicated. And I just want to draw people back to it because I think there's a lot of attempts to overcomplicate things. Honorable Breitenbach saying wouldn't be possible to prosecute. The bill does two things, the offense of hate crime, an existing offense, the underlying offense, which in addition to that is motivated by the perpetrator's prejudice or intolerance towards the victim because of actual perceived characteristics. So it's existing crimes which become hate crimes. You've just got to prove the motivation of the perpetrator. That list is quite long, because we don't think that making something a hate crime because the motivation is because of the group you belong to is something that is going to severely infringe on people's rights. The purpose of creating the crime of hate crime or having this category of hate crimes is to ensure proper recording, is to ensure that things like the voice of the victim is heard, or the victim or their family if the victim is deceased. That is a requirement that we've put in, that they must lead a victim impact statement and tell the court, give the court reasons if they can't. And then it's issues relating to training as it is with hate speech. So chair and members, that's hate crime. What is so complicated about hate crime? On the issue of hate speech, which is the more contentious one, as I would admit, it is a new crime. I think Mr. Horn had raised, I mean, the requirement following on from Kwelane is you've got to prove two things. Well, you've got to prove a number of other things, but two, the nub is basically the two things with two subsections, which are ORs. You've got to show it's harmful or incite harm. Not both of them. There's an or there. That or was not challenged. You've got to prove that it is either harmful or incites harm. And then you also have to prove that it propagates or promotes hatred. So if you can prove that it is harmful and promotes hatred, you've complied with that section. It's not necessary to put all four down. Now, 16.2 of the Constitution, I unfortunately don't have my Constitution in front of me, lists, I think it is racism. It lists, I think, a number of narrow categories as saying if this is done and it's incitement to harm, then it is not free speech. What we've done and what Kwelane did is through the limitations clause, and Kwelane accepted that homophobia, which is not in 16.2, could be a ground for hate speech. And we have then added other points to that. In terms of the rethink, we have limited that grouping because this is affecting rights of free speech. So we've taken out provisions that really there can be hate speech on and people can be killed, like, for example, political affiliation or conviction. A lot of people in the past and still get killed just because of their political affiliation, but that's not a ground for hate speech because we felt that it would restrict free speech. So we've limited those grounds to albinism, ethnic or social origin, gender, HIV and AIDS, nationality, migrant or refugee status or asylum seekers, race, religion, sex, or sexual orientation, gender identity, expression or sex characteristics. So it's a narrow, much smaller group. You will notice that language is not there. Language is down as one of the characteristics for hate crime, because people could be attacked on the basis of the language group that they belong to. I note the unhappiness with the document and the references to Afrikaans, but look, the reality unfortunately is that the case law, the only language that there's really been any jurisprudence on is the issue of the rights of Afrikaans. But the intention is basically as with having language as a ground for a hate crime, is that if somebody is attacked because of their language group, and that could include a person advocating the use of Afrikaans at a university. If an Afrikaans person is attacked because of that, that would be then a ground for it being a hate crime, if there's an assault, an attempted murder, whatever. So we think it benefits people. But those grounds are basically grounds that are, yes, they do limit freedom of speech, but we think they are very serious grounds. HIV and AIDS may have receded a bit because people are more accepting of it, But the issue would be, in the past, people have been killed simply on the basis of their HIV status. Google Dlamini, for example. I think it was. And that really, in a sense, could happen. So that's what the hate speech provisions are, that if you follow these requirements in Kwelane, of you say something that is harmful or incites harm and promotes or propagates hatred, then it would be hate speech. We've then made this provision and tightened it, that effectively, if it's artistic or creative performance or expression, academic or scientific inquiry, fair or accurate reporting, the media, and then interpreting, proselytizing, or espousing any religious tenet, belief, teaching, doctrine, or writing, that it's a higher bar that has to be passed there. And that the limitation on that bar for the artists, the academics, the reporters, the people who want to proselytize, is that they can't advocate hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm based on any of the grounds. So we followed basically the wording, Mr. Swart, in 16.2 there. We think that we are not taking away anything that isn't in 16.2. So that's the bill quite simply. And then it's other aspects of the victim impact statement, training, et cetera. So, Chair, I want to sort of also deal with the process. Mr. Swart has raised, the bill was introduced in 2018. Mr. Swart correctly says, well, it got delayed because of waiting for Kwelane on hate speech. I don't recall Mr. Swart, that the committee said that it must be separated or things like that. I think that was your perspective. But Kwelane, the judgment came out on the 31st of July, 2021. That's well over a year ago. This committee then started hearings on the bill on the 29th of March this year. March 17, May, 18 May. It started deliberations on the bill on the 7th of September. There have been a number of meetings on the 7th of September, 9th, 21st, 26th, 4th of November, 8th of November. My concern is that this bill is needed in society. As government, we've said we feel we need this bill to provide for hate crimes, to provide for hate speech. That is supported by people in civil society. I think my concern here, and it's not a complicated bill. You know, the other thing that we've urged before is look at the definition of harm, which we had, I think the committee had some discussions on that previously. But those are the elements. Which are the grounds? Which are the characteristics? Look at the definition of harm. But my concern, Chair, is that if we're honest and if members are honest, there are parties here that do not support the bill and will not, I'm sure, support the bill. The chairperson of the Democratic Alliance, Ms. Zilla, wanted to hold a press conference just before the local government elections attacking this bill. The DA are not going to. I doubt if they will tell Ms. Zilla to get lost. They will not support this bill. Mr. Swart is saying, well, he's not so opposed to the hate crimes element, but he is, I know, concerned about the hate speech element and whether it will restrict freedom of religion. We feel that, Mr. Swart, that it won't, that what is there is basically not going really any further than what is in 16.2 of the Constitution as far as proselytizing. So, Chair, I really want to urge that I'm just feeling that, particularly from the inputs here, that there's a lot of obfuscation coming out. This is a problem, that's a problem. Mr. Swart also surprisingly talks about further consultations. I mean, Chair, as you know, and he raised at the beginning of the meeting, have you seen the letter from whoever, religious grouping? I haven't seen it. It wasn't sent to me. But we published a draft comment on a draft version of the bill as the department before it came to Parliament. We had engagements, many engagements with religious groups on the bill before it was introduced into Parliament. It was then introduced into Parliament. You've had public hearings. It can't go on and on. So Chair, I really would urge you that really, I think we are, with respect, and I'm sure they will deny it, but honestly, if they look at their hearts, that this bill is just being delayed. It is a very important bill, but it's a very serious bill, but the sections of it are not that complicated. What's the definition of harmful or harm? What are the grounds for, the characteristics for hate crime? And language should be there, but we don't want to put language under hate speech in case it restricts debate. And then the issues of hate speech, and we've been over this issue, Chair, so many times. We have criminalinuria, but we wanted as government to say we need a statutory crime because criminalinuria is an old Roman Dutch law crime, and we feel it needs to be developed by Parliament. So, Chair, I really would urge the members, I think they should read the document that was produced. I would say if the officials want to respond to anything. Just going back to the Afrikaans issue, both Ms. Buerta, well, I presume she's Afrikaans with a surname like Buerta, but she would have Afrikaans heritage. Definitely, Henk is Afrikaans. You can see that. They're proud Afrikaners, or he is a proud Afrikaner. There was no attempt to undermine Afrikaans people. I think the issue was that the examples, the jurisprudence is on Afrikaans because that's the language that has been subject to disputes in court. But Chair, I think let me leave it like that for now, but my appeal would be, please let's get back to, I'm told Ms. Buerta is not Afrikaans, she's Mary the Buerta. So my apologies, Ms. Buerta. But definitely Mr. Dupria is Afrikaans. You can tell from his accent. And things. So, Chair, I really want to urge that please can we get to grips with the real issues in the bill, the text of the bill, and those that don't want to support the bill, we know you don't want to support it. You can vote against it in the House. But please, we can't keep delaying this bill indefinitely. This committee also has a lot of other work to do, other legislation that is coming, sign language, magistrates, things like that. So that would be my appeal, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Chair, sorry, also I have to leave at about 10 past 12 to attend a meeting actually with the UN, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. I can ask you, Mr. Swart, about the Rabat program of action. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Dupria?
Chair, could I interrupt and just ask Mr. Dupria to speak Afrikaans to just make sure whether he is Afrikaans or not?
No, there are people who can speak Afrikaans very well, even if they're not Afrikaans.
Just joking, Chair.
Asseblief. Soos ek, ja. Asseblief, man.
Neem meneer Jantjies, jy is nie Afrikaans, jy ons weet dit.
Ek praat oorspronklike Afrikaans. Moenie vir my lei sê nie, is my tweede taal Afrikaans, asseblief.
Luister net hoe mooi jy by uitspraak.
Hey,
can we proceed?
Thank you,
Chair. Can I just withdraw Yelich? I think it's unparliamentary.
Mr. Chair, I think you skipped Ms. Breitenbach.
No, it was deliberate. I just, members, with your permission, can we have the department said we are done, then we can come back to members because they would want to debate some of the issues. That is one approach that I'm proposing, that let's ensure that we have a totality of response, then we can come back to members and then members can have a second bite.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to mention to you, Mr. Chair, that this note was prepared in response to issues that were raised by Mr. Horan. I don't like to refer to individual members of the committee, but the issues that have been raised by Mr. Swart is additional to the note that we have proposed or submitted to the committee in response to questions that were raised by Mr. Horan. If there are any additional questions that will be raised, we will respond to that. But I think that we've reached the stage where we would like to receive those questions through you, Chair, in writing, because as the Deputy Minister said, we are reaching a stage where we are really going in a direction where we are not focusing on the technical aspects of the bill itself, and those are my main concerns. Is I would like to get a bill approved that is technically correct. And with regard to the Afrikaans language, once again, I don't know whether it's really necessary to take an issue with that. It's the judgments that are available. It's those issues that have been raised. In fact, Mr. Chair, this bill protects languages. So, from my side, I see my DDG would like to say something as well, if you would allow it, Chair.
No, complete your responses, then we'll go to her.
I have nothing to add to the stage, Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pillay.
Chairperson, I just want to add something to what Mr. Dupriya started speaking to, which is the nature of the document and NHA which we submitted. Chair, if you will note, the documents are actually worded Research Note 1 and Research Note 2. NHA is an attachment to Research Note 1. It reflects the research that we had done following the questions from the committee and the committee's request that they would like the department to explain, for instance, and through the members of the committee, the rationale, the explanation for the grounds and the criteria and those other issues, which is what we sought to do in the document itself. Then the document itself, and this is just to say something further to guide the members when they go through the documents, you will find that we've quoted a lot of case law. There are excerpts from other legislation where we try to draw commonalities in the ground, for instance, with regard to the employment equity, where we quote the grounds, etc. And one of the points that came up is also as justification and as an issue of why would we include color, for instance. And color, you will find, as an explanation of the number of international conventions where it appears and our own legislation, for instance. So it was all in part of explaining the grounds and explaining the characteristics and the criteria. And then finally, Chairperson, we used the latest constitutional court cases that we could find as relevant as an explanation of the categories. And it's only to explain how does a problem arise, for instance, in respect of language or in respect of birth. And I think you would have noted from Ms. Boerter's comments. We couldn't find, when we submitted the document, we could not find those cases in respect of birth, but she subsequently found it and she spoke to those issues as the research had come to the fore. So Chairperson, I would like to end there as merely a guidance to the committee in terms of how we went about drawing up that document. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pillay. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Of course, we remain grateful to the department for their serious commitment to assisting us with this legislation and other legislation. I take mild offence at being lectured by the Deputy Minister about how and when we should do our job. This committee is now seized with this piece of legislation. And this committee must engage with it until this committee is satisfied that we have done a proper job. So for the Deputy Minister to tell us that it's been here long enough and we need to get a move on, well, that may be his view, but that view cannot be the motivation of this committee. We passed this legislation. We will have to argue it in the House. We will have to present it, and we will have to live with it and its consequences. So as and when we feel that we have engaged sufficiently and interrogated sufficiently all of the aspects of this piece of legislation, then this committee will be ready to move on. And until then, we won't be. And I will not be rushed. So just as an example, I don't know if anybody who's worked on this piece of legislation or the Deputy Minister has consulted with anybody in the criminal justice system, those people, the prosecutors, you're going to have to prosecute this piece of legislation with how it looks, with how it sounds, with what's contained in it, and how do they think they're going to prove the elements of the crimes that are now set out herein. What this piece of legislation does is it elevates what is now a legitimate aggravating circumstance, very aggravating circumstance, that would have serious consequences in any criminal case, but that can be mentioned from the bar, is now elevated to an element of a criminal offence which must be proved beyond reasonable doubt. It's extremely difficult. It makes the job of the prosecutor much harder. It makes the job of the police investigating it much harder. And it's exceptionally difficult to prove state of mind at the best of times. So I don't know if any thought has been given to that, but it's certainly one of the aspects that we are giving thought to. And I want to consult, and I consider myself an expert in criminal law and criminal law prosecution, believe me. But there are people who are more experienced than me, and I intend to consult them in this regard. And until I've done that, I will not be ready to interrogate this document with any kind of completeness, and I would have abdicated my duty to this committee and to South African citizens if I do not satisfy myself on all of those elements. And there are other elements that bother me too. The Deputy Minister is quite correct. We do not support this bill. But seem to suggest that we're deliberately dragging our feet and kicking for touch, I find mildly offensive, and I do take offense. It is our job as part of this committee to do a proper job to produce good legislation that meets the requirements that we say we wanted to meet. And at the moment, this piece of legislation does not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Breitenbach. Honorable Horn.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yes, I agree with the Honorable Breitenbach's remarks regarding the duty of this committee, and I, given that Mr. Depree has also said that the document is primarily a response to my previous submission, I would want to point out that the one thing to which the department has not responded is my suggestion that in order to criminalize hate speech, must constitutionally be a much more complex exercise than just looking at the clarity around the definition of hate speech provided by Kulani, and then deciding on a list of criteria. And as I said in the beginning, at the first glance, and that's specifically now in response to the Deputy Minister's statements, at a first glance, some of the information supplied in what I think we called Annex A, or which is now I think also termed Submission 2, seems to carry weight. And in saying that we want to consider it somewhat further, I don't think is an attempt to delay, as already has been pointed out. It was sent to us late last night, and we're not in a position to now, in a passive aggressive way, say now we want 2 weeks or whatever, but we really just want some time to digest specifically Annex A further. For example, Chair, the part that was added verbally today, I mean, just in the meantime, reflecting on the fact that two court cases that basically dealt with the station and the, let's say, the right of either adopted children or children born out of wedlock to not be discriminated against, has created this question in my mind as to how those cases, even though they've now been found as talking to aspects around birth, can be related in relation to criminalization. It's one thing to say to people having familial relationships with adopted children and children born out of wedlock that by law in South Africa, as a matter of rights, you cannot discriminate against them. But are we then going to say that going forward, attempts to exclude such family members will be the type of discrimination that will now lead to criminal prosecution? So once again, Chair, even though on face value some of the information shared talks to the criteria, I really do believe all members should spend a bit more time to see whether the information shared really substantiates an argument that these criteria could be justified. And I'm making no excuses for my argument to say that if we are ever going to pass a constitutionally compliant piece of legislation, we should, as Parliament, insist that the executive come and justify all the criteria they want to include in a proper manner. Otherwise, what invariably will happen going forward, and this must be put on the record, is that the courts will perform that job, and who will take ownership of that now? So the Deputy Minister has now twice referred to the fact that the Chair of the Federal Council of the DA seemingly wanted to arrange a press conference about this piece of legislation. The Deputy Minister on the other side of this is on record in this committee on a number of occasions, I want to say more than two, that what we should really do is just pass the legislation and then leave it up to the courts to decide. And that statement ultimately should create tension between this committee and the Deputy Minister, healthy tension, I would hope, because that simply is not our task. Our task is to try and ensure that whatever we pass into law will meet constitutional muster or pass constitutional muster. So, Chair, yes, once again, a request. I must also admit that I gave an undertaking that by yesterday I would provide a small submission on the hate crimes component. I've not been able to finalize it. I'm not that well at the moment, physically. The Deputy Minister might argue that it's also in other aspects, but I would want to still provide that, and at this stage maybe just also ask the department, because this is along the lines of which I have been working on a document, to please also go and consider in circumstances where if we settle on the route of addressing hate crimes in the way it's proposed currently in the bill. So we've in the past referred to the fact that in some jurisdictions, the fact that a crime was motivated based on bias or prejudice or hate or whatever we want to call it, is then seen as an aggravating circumstance. I think the Deputy Minister has previously also stated that that's of course already permissible within our law. And that would then lead to the imposition of harsher sanctions once it's introduced during the sanctioning phase. I want to refer back to the fact that the Honourable Breitenbach has argued strongly, and as she says, she's much more of an expert than I am on criminal law, that to ultimately prove motivation or animus or intent, they all related, I think, in the circumstances, based on this prejudice, will be a fairly high hurdle to overcome for a prosecutor. So the question I've been wrestling with, and which I've tried to do some research on, but which I've not been able to finalize, and maybe the department can also assist, is in the event where that motive is not proven beyond reasonable doubt, what would be then the permissibility of information to the effect that there was, let's say, a likelihood or a probability that the perpetrator committed the crime based on the specific prejudice or hatred during the sanctioning phase? So the way I understand it at the moment, in South Africa, there's no requirement that aggravating and mitigating factors be proven beyond reasonable doubt or in the case of the accused on a balance of probabilities. But my fear is this, and I'm saying this really because the Deputy Minister seems to be of the view that we in no circumstances want any of this to become law. My fear is this, that if we're going to settle on this version of hate crimes, and we do, and the prosecution do not satisfy the demand of proving motive beyond reasonable doubt, that in order to treat the accused fairly, it might ultimately be found that we can then not, on when sanction is considered, or provide any information which then in other circumstances could have led to an aggravation of sentence. And I think it's something real we should consider. We can't make a law on the assumption that our prosecution will all of a sudden find special ways and means to prove motive. Of course, in certain circumstances, specifically in the day and age of social media and live streaming, we know that in extreme cases, people go as far as to boast about their prejudice before committing crime. But those are really the extreme cases. And if we really want to be serious as a country in dealing with hate crimes, we must also consider that there could be a move as a consequence if we pass the law in its current form to really hide motives better. And I want the department to consider what the effect will then be if we cannot prove that beyond reasonable doubt on the ultimate outcome in terms of sanction. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. We wish you a speedy recovery. Get well soon. Honorable Sort.
No, thank you, Chair. I appreciate the DM's going to look into the robot principle. Look forward to hearing from him in that regard. And I also appreciate now a better understanding of the document being in response to Mr. Horn's document. So in that context, I will understand what Mr. Dupria says. I mean, we've come a long way together, Mr. Dupria. I know he's always bona fides, his heart is right, but there's no ways I can be told. I can only put questions in writing. But I understand in the context of what you meant was if it was a formal submission that you would like to respond to. So when I put those questions, I think they do require an answer, but at some stage, we can maybe think about it. Straightforward questions that are put on paragraph 3.7, where the department says no such relief is present. Now we know there is a relief. Whether it is sufficient or not, obviously is a policy consideration, and the government, the executive has decided that they don't want to make use of the common law, they want to make use of a statutory offence, but you can't say no such relief is present. So that's the type of questions that I want clarity on. I think that it's, as far as the DM, Deputy Minister concerned, in the previous parliament, we had a definite discussion about the splitting of the bill, but that's neither here nor there. We had that discussion. It wasn't carried. The decision wasn't finalized because of the Quilani judgment. But I do think I appreciate this document and that we need to study it. We need to understand that. My comments about the hate crimes, hate speech working group, I fully understand if the department works with them, but that's fine. We just need to know that, you know, if that is the interested parties, because obviously that would be in line with what the department's policy is. So those type of general questions to me are quite innocuous, interested parties, but I appreciate what Mr. Dupria says in the context of a response to a formal document, which I might still try to prepare something, but my thoughts are pretty much what I expressed already, and the DM has already referred to that. So I appreciate the discussion. I think what is transpired in the last few meetings is a narrow discussion on the limitations clause and on the need, and that's why I appreciate what Mr. Dupria says about the technical refinements. I think at the end of the day, whether we're going to support it or not, it's always been my approach as the longest serving member of this committee to make sure the document, the act, whether I support it or not, is constitutionally compliant, as so that we don't have those challenges at a later stage. And that's why I also take to heart what the Honourable Breitenbach says about the prosecution of these matters. So I would urge the department to have that input with the NPA. I think we've come a long way, and I think that we are near to a finalization, but there is still a process that needs to be engaged with, talking to people, considering this document, considering the annexes, and maybe consulting more widely. Thank you, Chair. By the way, I did not at any stage suggest that public participation should be reopened. What I did just indicate was that there is correspondence that needs to be referred to, where genuine concerns have been expressed by the Association of Christian Media, and there's even a request for a legal opinion. So these are issues that we need to respond to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dupré.
Chair, sorry, my hand was up. Can I come in now because I will need to leave and then Mr. Dupré can come after me?
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. No, just a few short responses. Just firstly, I'm sorry to hear, and I mean it genuinely, Mr. Horn, you have been through a difficult time. I'm sorry to hear you're not well, and I wish you a speedy recovery. On the issue of the NPA, with due respect to members, of course we've consulted the NPA. We consulted them when the bill was in the version that was introduced in 2018, and because we recognize that they are the people who are going to prosecute. We've been in regular contact. I've been sending them copies of the latest drafts. You know, we have consulted them. We don't do things relating to crimes without them. I do also, you know, I'm not saying the committee must just pass legislation and leave it up to the courts. The issue is the committee must consider and apply its mind, but it can't do that endlessly, and ultimately the final arbiter will be the court. On the issue of the hate crimes element, that yes, the current situation is that the hate motive is an matter for aggravation of sentence. We can check, Mr. Horn, whether that stops it. If that doesn't succeed and the person gets convicted only of assault but not of a hate crime, whether that will impact on whether the prosecution can no longer lead evidence when it comes to sentence. I would have thought they could, but it's a different test. It's balance. It's beyond reasonable doubt in the first instance. And these are factors to be taken into account. And they're no longer dealing with guilt. It's a question of sentence. But we can check that with the NPA. Just on this SWAT issue, maybe Mr. Dupreer would respond to it as well. But Section 10 of PAPUDA, Section 10.1, which is prohibition of hate speech. Section 10.1 is the hurtful, harmful, or hurtful's gone. Section 10.2, which Mr. Swart says is an indication of what the department says is not true, because there is another remedy, that the court may, the quality court, refer any case dealing with this hate speech to the DPP for institution of criminal prosecutions in terms of common law or legislation. I guess there is the issue of common law, but does criminal injuria, you know, it's specifically about hate speech. Do we have a definition of hate speech in common law? I don't think we do. Criminal injuria is not hate speech. It's something else. So look, maybe it's a more technical point, but the intention, as Mr. Swart knows, is that we were going to pass legislation dealing with hate speech after we finished PAPUDA. Chair, yeah, I just wanted to add those points, and thanks very much, and I would have to leave. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, DM. I think before you leave, I just want to raise this issue because I do think that it's important, the context is important. There are other people who are watching who might not have that context. If we are going to just count days, we are going to be taking things out of context. It would seem to somebody who is listening at home as if the committee is unduly delaying some of the laws being passed. But you would agree with me that that is not the only thing we do, that is the first thing. And between, let's start just early this year, the things that we have been doing, the laws that we have been passing, including issues of meeting constitutional court deadlines because things were just brought to us last minute. We had to pass, we did pass the Land Court Bill. We had to deal with the international treaties. We have to deal with the oversight of the Department of Justice, Correctional Services, with also the appeals on their side. We have to deal with the Office of the Chief Justice. So it's not the only bill that we have been dealing with. Now, if we're going to count days, I think we're going to be taking just things out of context. We are really pressed with a lot of issues. And we are only 11 here. I do think that that contest should be really be taken to in its rightful impact. It should really be explained that even people who are generally listening is that it's not as if we are just delaying this bill because we are lazy to work or what, but there are just too many issues that we are dealing with, and all of them sometimes they are very urgent. We have to deal with two constitutional court deadlines, one in December, which has been extended, in fact, December 2, and then the other one, the drug trafficking. But all of them, they require our immediate attention. So I thought it's important that as the person who's chairing the committee, I must also explain that. Thank you very much, dear.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just to say that, no, I appreciate the I was not criticizing the committee, and it's not the length of time, but it's the number of meetings that have taken place on this bill. And people have had lots of time to consider the issues. That's the point that I was raising, but it was more aimed at specific members of the committee as a whole. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, dear. I think you can be excused. Mr. Duclair.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to respond, and I would really like you to appreciate that I do have respect for each and every member of your committee, including yourself as chairperson. I know it's a difficult job to do at times. But I cannot impress that more upon you. I really respect all the members of the committee. That having been said, Mr. Chair, the concern was raised on the difficulty of prosecuting a murder or an assault as a hate crime. And that is why we have the proposed what is currently 270 capital A, which we would like to change to 269B as a competent verdict. If we accuse or prosecute, for example, murder as a hate crime, and we as prosecutors are not successful, but we prove the other elements of the crime, then it is a competent verdict for the court to find you guilty of assault or murder. My job, Mr. Chair, as I've been tasked for the past 22 years, is to advise the committee on a technical level. Maybe I should leave it at that this stage, Chair, but I think it's now an opportune time to go into the technicalities of the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dupree. No, we really do appreciate your technical guidance. In fact, that unit, whether it's you or it's Ms. Pillay, Ms. Borda, the other one, the one who's dealing with cannabis,
General Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Roberts, we are very happy with the unit, with the quality of support that we are getting. I mean, from time to time, things would be intense. It's not a reflection on yourselves. It's the emotive, it's the emotions that are sometimes generated by the issue at hand. And I think even amongst ourselves, I mean, there is a lot of respect amongst ourselves, but there will be times where the issue at hand is just requires some intensity in terms of discussions, and nothing is personal against anyone. It's a robust environment, but we always maintain respect for one another. So nothing is directly intended against anybody. We have a lot of respect for that, for you as officials who are assisting us, both in terms of your integrity and in terms of your technical expertise that you render. But from time to time, I think there will be those robust debates, but you are generally focusing on the issues, not at the person. I think members, can I suggest the following? I think the general consensus that I'm hearing is that one, all members across political spectrum are saying that they would need some time to go through the document. Others at West, they were able, they saw the document this morning. Others, they glanced at it last night. I think I read the first document. I saw the other document. I did not read the second document. It would be important that we go through the documents, we internalize the documents, and then we can be in a position to engage further. Can I suggest that the next meeting be on the 25th after we have met with the NPA? I think it will be next week Friday. Members would have had enough time to go through the document. I think we will, I suggest that we meet after we have met the NPA, we go through the bill, or we go through the debates that we are having, and then, but I think we need to come back to the bill ultimately, so that we can see how far do we go. Then secondly, I think we should also, the extension of the program to the 6th, we must answer the question, what is the impact on us? Will we be able to meet as committees or it will just be time or just we will still stick to the program as it is and wait for the 6th to debate the Phalaphala issues? Should we not use some of the days to see how far will we push the issue of cannabis and this bill so that if we are not done, we will be in a position to know when we resume what is left. So that is what I'm putting to the committee for discussion and decision. Honorable Swart.
No, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to request some of the insertions into this, the annexes, if we can just get that in writing as well for the document. Completeness of the document. I think you might have to have a discussion with the chair of chairs about it, because my understanding of the program is it's a constituency period with a particular reservation for the debate on the 6th of December. So one would probably then have to apply for special permission. But I'm sure the chair of chairs would probably give you more guidance in that regard as to what other committees are doing. But my understanding is that it was a scheduled constituency period, with the exception of that debate on the 6th, the Phalaphala issue, and possibly the electoral amendment bill that might come back from the NCRP. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. I think that assists. Any other members on that? Or we will interact with the Office of the House Chair and come back to members. But we also note that members have been working very, very hard, and our officials are extremely tired, including departmental officials. let me say that during the workshop, we will finalize this matter as to whether we should take the 25th as the last engagement on this matter and not change the program, or if we should. I think we will update the committee. Will that be fine, members?
That's fine, Jim.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I do think that the cannabis bill. I think with respect to the cannabis bill, after next week, in fact, I think after next week, Mr. Roberts will be ready with the A list. But after that, after we have approved the A list, the issue of the JTC, it's out of our control. We would not instruct them when to sit and what to do. So we will await guidance from them. So let's work and see how far by the end of this term these two bills, how far do we push them. I think Mr. Dupree, you are, and Ms. Pillay, you would take all the issues you have been able to hear today and to update the documents, especially there's an issue of the issue of the annexes, and so that you can update and just email the documents to the committee secretary so that they can be distributed. And on Friday next week, members would have had time to read and internalize the documents. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Dupree. Thank you very much, Ms. Pillay and Ms. Botha. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I hope they are going to add this day because of your leave, because you have been working.
Remember, Chair, you promised me a salary raise.
salary raise and conferred to the senior counsel.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, can we come back to the issue of the BRRR? Or do you need a 5 minutes break before we deal with the BRRR, or we just go to the BRRR?
Chair, Steve,
Honorable.
No, I just wanted to find out, I might have missed the discussion around the workshop next week. Have we decided physical or virtual? I just need to make arrangements. Was that communicated?
I think Honorable Breitenbach was going to update us, but as far as I know, the decision is still it's still virtual, and then she appealed to members to reconsider their decision. I'm not aware of any reconsideration that was done. To the best of my knowledge, it is still virtual.
Thank you, Chair. 5 minutes break. I'm easy. If you want to continue, it's fine.
Members, 5 minutes break.
5 minutes.
Continue, Chair.
Thank you.
Honorable is in a very fiery mood today.
I just want to make a cup of tea.
Yeah, okay, sure.